making TV special.
Donuts. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means.
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
I don't want no police. I don't want no police around my door. No, I don't want no police. I don't want no policemen creeping around my front door. And if you do, nah, I don't want no fire trucks flashing pretty lights and driving up and down my block. Request that a certain part of you make sure you feel safe, make sure I feel safe. And if you can't, then I can't trust you. And I don't think it's any fun to have to invite 911.
If you do,
beginning in October, the Army plans to station active unit inside the United States for the first time to serve as an on-call federal response in times of emergency. The 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team has spent 35 of the last 60 months in Iraq, but now the unit's training for domestic operations. The unit will soon be under the day-to-day control of U.S. Army North, the Army service component of Northern Command. The Army Times reports this new mission marks the first time an active unit has been given a dedicated assignment to Northern Command. The paper says the Army unit may be called upon to help with civil unrest and crowd control. The soldiers are learning to use so-called non-lethal weapons designed to subdue unruly or dangerous individuals and crowds.
So, Benjamin, last time we talked, you were very sort of incognito talking about September 8th as an interesting date.
Well, actually, I don't know about September 8th, but, you know, the date I've been hearing is September 30th, and then some sort of event in the U.S. in October. So my understanding from my various sources is that there will be an attempt at a coup d'etat, martial law, and rounding people up for the detention camps in early October. These people have been trying very hard to start World War III. As you know, the Israelis had a Air Force base in Georgia, and they were planning to attack Iran's nuclear facilities from Georgia. The important thing is there was a friend of mine who was at the trilateral meeting in Tokyo in 2006 told me there was a technical explanation there where they said that because the Iranian facilities were so deep underground, they would have to attack them with nuclear weapons. Now, the Russians and the Chinese have said they will destroy Israel if they do that, okay? But I suspect the people behind this are ready to see Israel destroyed. This is going to be their new Holocaust in order to create the environment for their so-called Messiah to appear. So they're crazy, and they're trying to kill billions of people, and we're running out of time.
And we just might be running out of time, my friends. Welcome to this homemade B-side of episode 93 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. Coming to you from Portland, Oregon, 8:15 in the evening Pacific time on these last few hours of September 2008. So it's September 30th. And so we heard Benjamin Fulford talking about some sort of debt coming up on the 30th in the Bank of International Settlements and all that. And before that, we heard Amy Goodman reporting, which we posted it up on September 18th on Media Monarchy from the Army Times, Brigade Homeland Tours start October 1st. And we started off with Sloan, new music from them, Emergency 911. I just got to see them a few days ago here in Portland at Dante's, which is actually where Clyde Lewis does his great conspiracy internet broadcast, Ground Zero Lounge. But there's a lot of fear and a lot of paranoia and a lot of chatter about something going down. And it definitely feels like it, but we can't lose our heads wigging out about speculation. So, like I posted up, there's a lot of fear, a lot of chatter about martial law and canceled elections and a greater depression, all of which may very well be coming, but again, can't lose our heads and can't get divided. But anyway, I digress. I do want to thank you for picking up the show. I really appreciate it. All you guys that are out there, I see the downloads grow, so I really appreciate it. And you can, of course, hit me up on MySpace and Dig and YouTube and Yahoo, and hit me up on Instant Messenger and Skype, all with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And you get the podcast, archive.org, radioforall.net, and also through iTunes. So now that we have that initial stuff out of the way, and there are links up there, you can listen to that whole Benjamin Fulford interview and, of course, that Democracy Now! Episode and the Army Times article and subsequent links. But what we're going to get into on this episode are things that I couldn't get to Friday, of course, on episode 93, and it's two major things. A lot of 9/11 updates and the latest on Pakistan in the crosshairs. But first, 9/11 debates, Project Censored, tribunals, truth videos, and much, much more. This massive post starts out with a video link. There was a debate following the broadcast of the new documentary, Zero, that was in Russia. And so the videos are actually subtitled, and there's two parts, so you have to check those out because I'm not going to play subtitled audio for you. And that's just a follow-up on all the latest 9/11 truth that's been breaking more internationally than nationally lately. But other good news, 9/11 makes the top 25 censored stories for 2009. This brought to my attention, of course, from 911blogger.com. Now, it comes in at number 24. Japan questions 9/11 and the global war on terror. Testimony in the Japanese parliament, broadcast live on Japanese television in January 2008, challenged the premise and validity of the global war on terror. Parliament member Yukihisa Fujita insisted that an investigation be conducted into the war's origin, the events of 9/11. So if we hit that link and actually check out some of the other things on the Project Censored list this year. And I suppose they do actually rank these in order of importance. So we'll start at 25 and we'll count down. So number 25, Bush's real problem with Elliot Spitzer. Number 24, Japan questions 9/11. 23, FDA complicit in pushing pharmaceutical drugs. Number 22, CARE rejects U.S. food aid. 21, NATO considers first strike nuclear option. 20, marijuana arrests set new record. 19, indigenous herders and small farmers fight livestock extinction. 18, cruelty and death in juvenile detention centers. 17, UN's empty declaration of indigenous rights. 16, annual survey on trade union rights. 15, worldwide slavery. 14, mainstreaming nuclear waste. 13, tracking billions of dollars lost in Iraq. Number 12, Bush profiteers collect billions from No Child Left Behind. Number 11, El Salvador's water privatization and the Guat. Number 10, APA complicit in CIA torture. 9, Iraq and Afghanistan vets testify. Number 8, executive orders can be changed secretly. Number 7, Guest Workers Incorporated, fraud and human trafficking. Number 6, the Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. Number 5, seizing war protesters' assets. Number 4, ILEA is the U.S. restarting dirty wars in Latin America. Number 3, InfraGuard, the FBI deputizes business. Number 2, Security and Prosperity Partnership militarized NAFTA. and number one, over 1 million Iraqi deaths caused by U.S. occupation. So that's the 25 top censored stories for 2009. That's from Project Censored, projectcensored.org. If we move now to McClatchy for a two-parter here, it's the latest in the soap opera of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So first from McClatchy, alleged go-between Ramzi bin al-Shib refused to leave his prison camp cell Monday. This would be 2 Mondays ago now, triggering a clash on how to hold a pre-trial hearing in the complex conspiracy case for which prosecutors seek the death penalty. The standoff produced an eerie scene at the war court. Confessed mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed sat at the lead defense table, amiably chatting across the state-of-the-art courtroom with three of his alleged co-conspirators. White noise broadcast through war court speakers made the alleged terrorist conversations inaudible. All four former CIA-held captives compliantly wore the white uniforms of the prison camp. Mohammed, who at his June arraignment said he welcomed martyrdom, can be plainly seen in a massive gray speckled beard sitting at the defendant's table. He sported a white turban and black trim. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, prosecutors were working through Defense Department bureaucracy to see whether they could get an order to have bin al-Shib forced out of his cell and into the war court. This said by Air Force Major Gail Crawford, a military commission's spokeswoman. So, the part two to this from the Associated Press, Gitmo judge enlists help from 9/11 mastermind, confessed after years of beatings and worse. Confessed 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed offered Monday to help persuade one of his co-defendants to leave his prison cell for a pre-trial hearing at Guantanamo Bay. Mohammed volunteered to reach out to Ramzi bin al-Shib after the military judge overseeing the case suggested that he might offer a separate trial for bin al-Shib, who has refused to appear with his four co-defendants in America's most important war crimes trial since the close of World War II. Judge Ralph Coleman, K-O-H-L-M-A-N-N, a Marine colonel, permitted Mohammed and the other co-defendants to send notes to bin al-Shib. If the Yemeni still refuses to appear in court, bin al-Shib will be dragged from his cell, Coleman said. Quote, it is my hope that perhaps we can avoid the need for a forcible bringing of him here. And I'm not exactly sure what the latest on that is, so we'll have to check that out. Now for two of the lengthiest entries in this 9/11 updates post. It's 2 weeks worth of additions to the complete 9/11 timeline over on historycommons.org. So we're going to jump back to additions to the timeline as of September 21st. This concerns very much United 93 as well as the 9/11 Commission. So this, I believe, written by Kevin Fenton at History Commons. About half of this week's new entries concern United Airlines Flight 93. The airline's operations center sent a message to the plane's co-pilot some minutes before the hijacking, but received no reply. It also notified flights of a crash at the World Trade Center around 9:03, but did not send a warning about possible hijackings at this time. The airline's dispatchers were asked to warn flights at 9:21, the same time Flight 93 sent a routine message to one of the dispatchers. A couple minutes later, it checked in with Cleveland Air Traffic Control. The pilots then sent their last message at 9:27. And again, all the active verbs and things that you hear on there, these are all links. So there's 6 or 7 links right there in that first paragraph. Learning of potential problems on board, United tried to contact the plane at 9:31 and then sent a message to all flights, including Flight 93, telling them to secure their cockpits. Dispatchers learned Flight 93 was heading towards Washington at 9:36 and offered assistance, and a dispatcher issued another warning about securing the cockpit at 9:40. United's attempt to implement the lockout procedure for Flight 93 failed at about 9:50. At the same time, a dispatcher told 93 to land at the nearest airport and was informed the flight may have been hijacked. A few minutes after it crashed, a message was sent to the plane telling it not to divert to Washington, and none of the passengers' relatives went to the airport it was scheduled to arrive at in San Francisco to meet the passengers. In 2007, a German television program was denied permission to film the wreckage, which I believe we covered. So that's interesting. There were no relatives at the airport where it was supposed to be, even though there was mass confusion about where it was and what had happened. Continuing. Regarding the other flights, American Airlines ordered all of its flights to land immediately at 9:15, and the dispatcher notified United Flights of a ground stop in New York at 9:08. United ordered no new takeoffs for any international flights at about 9:20, and a dispatcher sent a warning to Flight 175 at 9:23, several minutes after it hit the World Trade Center. There are also a number of entries regarding the 9/11 Commission. Most importantly, as the Commission was just beginning its work in 2003, Executive Director Philip Zelikow had already completed an outline of its final report. Also, early on in the inquiry, the Commission decided it would not bother with subpoenas, which left Commissioner Max Cleland disappointed, to say the least. Later on, CIA Director George Tenet heard a false rumor the Commission was used to call for his firing and got White House Chief of Staff Andy Card to plead with the commissioners for his job. Now, the second one. Additions to the complete 9/11 timeline as of September 28th, the Pentagon on 9/11, shoe bombing, bin Laden in the Soviet-Afghan War, and more. And again, Kevin Fenton writing for HistoryCommons.org. This week, a massive amount of new entries have been added to the timeline dealing with a whole range of different issues. We'll start with the day of 9/11, in particular the Pentagon, which a fire chief warned could be a target nearly 20 minutes before it was hit. The attack itself created confusion by setting off 300 fire alarms, although some medical workers thought the ensuing evacuation was a drill. After wondering about outside the building, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld refused to follow the established emergency plan and evacuate, instead sending Deputy Paul Wolfowitz to an alternate military command center where the computers and communication systems did not work. The first fighter was seen over the Pentagon at around 10:40 a.m. The FAA sent the White House incorrect details of the hijacked planes in the early afternoon, and astronauts viewed the devastation in New York from space. Meanwhile, the FBI established a command post near the Pentagon and limited the evidence that needed to be photographed there. The day after the attacks, the FBI set up a joint operations center for its Pentagon response, and together with the NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, limited evidence recovery efforts there. There was a false alarm over an inbound plane that day and a sudden fire the next that disrupted recovery efforts. An apparently fake military official helped with the recovery for a couple days, then vanished. Again, this is September 12th. So, limited evidence recovery, false alarms, a fire, and fake military official. There's also a group of entries about congressional leaders' actions on 9/11. It was clear the Capitol Police was a possible, or rather, the Capitol was a possible target from around 9 a.m., but it was not evacuated until later. After the evacuation, some members of Congress established a central command center, but others went home. Some were flown to a secret bunker outside the Capitol, from which Vice President Darth Cheney instructed them not to return to Washington. They finally summoned up the courage to do so anyway in the early evening after agreeing to reconvene the next day. Another topic that has received more coverage is the 2001 attempted shoe bombing. Zacharias Moussaoui, one of the many 20th hijackers, met one of the bombers, Richard Reid, at a London mosque in 1996. Reid also met an al-Qaeda recruiter at London's Finsbury Park Mosque, which was run by British intelligence informer Abu Hamza al-Masri, and also attended by Nizar Trabelsi, T-R-A-B-E-L-S-I. And again, links, links, links. Another operative who went on to be involved in the shoe bombing. A few months before the attempted bombing, Reid cased targets in Israel. So again, these guys hanging out with British intelligence. The U.S. was monitoring calls between al-Qaeda communications hubs in Yemen and a top associate of the shoe bombers, leading to his arrest. That, in turn, led to Trabelsi's arrest, and that led to the arrest of a group of Algerians in Spain. All the plots Trabelsi was involved in were halted, except the shoe bombing, which was not canceled even after his arrest was revealed in the international press. In the event, Reid missed his flight because of extensive security checks and a repeat attempt was prevented by passengers and crew. Reid was sentenced to 80 years and Trabelsi also went to prison, as did some people linked to him. There are also several new entries about OBL's actions during the Soviet-Afghan War. He met with mysterious Europeans in Pakistan, and his brother Salim said he was the liaison between the U.S., the Afghan rebels, and the Saudi government in 1985 when President Ronald Reagan possibly viewed a video the Bin Laden brothers made about the war. The brothers also concluded a series of arms deals to help the war effort, lubricated by slush funds resulting from the Al-Yamamah arms deal between Saudi Arabia and Britain. For example, the Bin Ladens negotiated with South Africans in 1986. One of the translators at some of these meetings was Issam al-Ridi, R-I-D-I, who had a relationship with the CIA and helped the Arab Afghans purchase night vision goggles in the U.S. in the late 1980s. He also discussed shipping Stinger missiles to Africa with a close associate of Bin Laden and flew some al-Qaeda leaders on the first leg of a journey to Somalia before the Black Hawk Down incident. A leading Pakistani militant also made a similar trip. Al-Ridi later agreed to testify for the prosecution at the embassy bombings trial. There are also a few more entries about the Operation Bojinka plot. One of the plotters, Abdul Hakim Murad, M-U-R-A-D, was allegedly tortured by Philippine police after his arrest and then rendered to the U.S., as was lead plotter Ramzi Youssef. Another of the bombers, Wali Khan Amin Shah, mysteriously escaped from a Philippine jail but was recaptured a few months later and also rendered to the U.S. The recent 7th anniversary of the attacks was the occasion for the expression of some skepticism about what has come to be known as the official account of 9/11. A member of the European Parliament, Carl, called for an international tribunal to reassess the attacks. A former Syrian minister said the U.S. may have committed them itself, and a controversial documentary was shown on Russian television. That's, of course, Zero, the aforementioned documentary. Regarding the hijacker's DNA, the coroner handling the Flight 93 investigation received a call from a person who represented himself as one of the hijacker's relatives in 2002, but the remains of 13 hijackers are still in U.S. custody. Remains of the other six alleged hijackers have not been found. And we're going to hear more about the DNA in a few minutes. There's been a bit going on with censorship and supposed attacks and censorship on YouTube, and a lot of truth channels have been getting shut down. One of the big ones was somebody named Nuff Respect. So there's a posting truth videos targeted on YouTube. And an editor, notably from InfoWars, malicious activity appears to be government opt to discredit and take down Truth YouTube accounts, although there is no direct evidence of this. The Defense Department places a high value on controlling information, writes Mike Whitney. And I believe that was an article on Information Clearinghouse, and it's all about the Pentagon's Information Operations Roadmap. Considers the internet, quote, an enemy weapon system that must be confronted by way of virtual warfare and resulting in full spectrum dominance. And we went over that back in February on MediaMonarchy.com. And there is a little Nuff Respect video that goes along with this and urging you to get active and replicate sites and just keep at it and don't quit. A new one from Jerry Mazza at the online journal, M-A-Z-Z-A. Tons of great articles he writes. And again, I got to thank Richard Andrew Grove for turning me on to him. The 9/11 movement is alive, well, and kicking in New York City and beyond. He goes on, and again, this is still, we're still getting kind of anniversary stuff, 7th anniversary, but he mentions We Are Change and, of course, the New York City Ballot Initiative and fundraising efforts, First Responders First, and more. But now, let's jump to the remains. 7 years later, 9/11 hijackers' remains are in limbo. Now, this is from the New York Times, and again, with a 9/11 blogger editor's note. If I had a nickel for every time we had been told the ongoing investigation of 9/11 is being the reason why we can't have access to information, I would be a rich man. 7 years after the terrorist attack of September 11th, the remains of 13 of the 19 men responsible have been identified and are in the custody of the FBI and the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. But no one has formally requested the remains in order to bury them. politically, one can understand that this is a hot potato, said Munir Farid, Secretary General of the Islamic Society of North America and a former professor of Islamic Studies. People don't want to identify with the political equivalent of Jeffrey Dahmer. What would happen if someone asked for the hijackers' remains is not clear. Neither the FBI, which holds the remains of the nine hijackers whose planes hit the Pentagon and crashed in a field in Somerset County, Pennsylvania, nor the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, which holds the remains of four of the ten hijackers who flew planes into the World Trade Center buildings, has policies to deal with such a request. So, again, neither the FBI or the New York City Medical Examiner's Office has policies to deal with such a request. If and when it comes up, we'll address it then, an FBI spokesman, Richard Kokor, said. The Bureau could turn down such requests because the September 11th investigation is an open case. And again, they've been using that forever. New Al CIA to tape surfaces despite U.S. efforts to block it. And again, we've hit this one repeatedly. They were going to try and get an anniversary video out, and then supposedly it was stopped, and then now it's maybe out again. So this coming from the blotter, Ryan Ross, and all that on ABC. Al-Qaeda's annual September 11th propaganda video surfaced, delayed 8 days by a concerted U.S. effort to block it. The tape showed no new pictures or statements from Osama bin Laden, although an Al-Qaeda figure was interviewed saying bin Laden was in good health. Al-Qaeda also showed a video it said was captured from a U.S. bounty hunter, Keith Jack Adema, I-D-E-M-A, as he appeared to threaten to kill an Afghani citizen during an interrogation.
Bin Laden hasn't been there since December 2001. That's 2.5 years. Why we lied? Unless he was trying to lie about everything. He's going too far in his lie now. Now I believe he is. He is exactly who we believe in. There's no doubt in my mind now because of that. Why would you lie about something so insignificant, something that is so meaningless? Ask him. Describe the house to him. Tell him I know that everybody in Jalalabad knew where it was. And why would he lie? Bin Laden has been gone for 3 years. Why would he not admit to knowing where the house was? Everybody in Jalalabad knew where the house was.
I saw the bazaar there to unknown family. This is the rapper, Samar. I'm a farmer. I'm a brother. 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 تو که در خیلی بیاد یه گردی یعنی که بسا خود که خود فامیل رو بگوری ما چطور بیتونی بسر تو رسال تو نیم تو رئیس دیوز می پایین
من هم این آشان در پیسی دارم در من نوشی بگردم در حقیقت جمعه فامیل ما الان هم در این شعر در این مرتبه بله در این آشان
سی بلا بسکون بوده بسی در این رو می نوزی بله در این
At 50 years old, he's never left. The small, tiny city of Jalalabad.
The Pinjas of Comedy and Shark of Hotel again and Jams, John Jalalabad, South Korea.
That's the other line.
I'm not a German community, I never see the Pinjas.
I'm not a thing of Malaysia, I'm sure. I'm not a woman, I'm not a woman. And then there's nothing that I shall share. Maybe two or more when I think. I don't know if she's the name of Hannah.
You see, I've heard the Khugiani name, I've heard the Cholagora name, but I've never been there.
And he said that it was never been outside the village.
Yeah.
He said he's never been outside Jalalabad, is what he just said.
No, he said that he has never been outside Jalalabad.
Well, where is his village?
Khadetam village.
Saracha,
the village.
Sarajevo, they made a lot of money in Paris.
I
showed you about the bank of the family.
What is that? Tell them basically I'm tired of the lies. Where's this village?
Khadija.
Sarajevo.
How far from Jalalabad?
It's called the village.
How far from the family?
5 feet.
See, it's Jalalabad. 5 feet, how far?
Chalabad.
Well,
50 minutes from Jalalabad.
So he has been at Jalalabad. And he has been. So he has been outside of Jalalabad. He just lied. He said he never left the city. He just lied and said he never left the city.
Saracha is his village. Like, this is the city of Jalalabad. And this is the way to go to Khan. It isn't. It is belong to the city of Jalalabad.
But he just said he never left his small little city. His small little area. He never even went around the city.
تو گفتی بیشتر که من چه از شاد جلوه بیرون نرفتیم بازار حرام نگم بیرون
He's saying this our village, of course. I went to my village.
Oh, but that's not what he said before. Yeah, before he said he never went outside the village.
He's saying that's my village, of course.
I know. Oh, he lied. Tell him that in 3 minutes. In 3 minutes, he'll be dead. How does he want to talk?
Does he want to talk? Hello. Come on, come on.
Of course he can talk.
Does he want to
talk? Actually, we're not tight enough. He'd have 5 minutes this way. Tell him to make it so he's only got 3 minutes. Does he want to talk now?
Not missing anyone.
Does he want to talk?
Not missing. Not missing.
Ask him now. He wants to tell me the truth when he went outside the village.
Do you have a lot of missing anyone? Huh?
No, that. No, he said I was off.
Oh, that was nice. The army guys will leave it on for 2 minutes.
And now, even more good international news for 9/11 Truth. Press TV did a television show and also posted it up on the website, presstv.ir, out of Iran. Truth to the 9/11 conspiracy theories. So Press TV, the international news network, delves into the 9/11 conspiracy theories. And it's a 7-part YouTube posting. Not a whole lot of great information, but it's definitely worth checking out the first few minutes of Truth to the 9/11 conspiracy theories from Press TV.
I'm Nick Ferrari, and this is the topical debate show where the people ask the questions. On a bright, sunny September morning 7 years ago this week, the main concern for most New Yorkers on their way to work was coping with the subways and traffic or deciding where to get their morning coffee. In the space of a few minutes, that was dramatically and tragically changed. Furthermore, the events of that day were to change the world forever. 2,974 people were killed in the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, Pentagon, and on Flight 93. An additional 24 are missing, presumed dead, and 19 terrorists died carrying out their suicide missions. The tragedy ushered in the war on terror, military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Guantanamo Bay detention center, and civilians accepting an unparalleled erosion of civil liberties. Now, all these years on, as the horror subsides, the feeling that the truth behind those dark September days is still not known grows. So today we're asking, is there any truth to the 9/11 conspiracy theories? Now to discuss these issues, an expert panel. To my right, Nick Pope, who headed a number of projects at the British Ministry of Defence from 1985 to 2006. And to his right, Wendy Grossman, founder of the UK's Skeptic magazine. To my left, Annie Machen, former MI5 officer and prominent member of the 9/11 Truth Movement. And to her left, Ian Henschel, author of a number of books about 9/11, the most recent being 9/11, The New Evidence. Welcome to you all. And now for our first question. Let's go out to Nicola Nawana. Nicola.
If 9/11 was a terrorist attack, then why did George Bush refuse an official investigation for 2 years?
Indeed, this is a theory interested by commentators in the US. Let's put that to Nick Pope. Why?
Well, I think in the aftermath of the incident, everyone was really too busy dealing with the fallout of what had happened and actually trying to go after the people that had done that, namely Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. But eventually, of course, we did get the 9/11 Commission report. And, you know, it is an extremely thorough investigation. Now, okay,
said themselves that they were set up to fail by being starved of funds, by being starved of testimony, and by having a load of Washington placemen serving on them. There wasn't an independent person on the commission.
Totally discredited in your
view? Oh, yeah, it's totally. I mean, by their own admission. Very unusual for a government commission to produce a book like that, for it to be bombarded all over the mainstream media, and then 2 years later, the chief of the commission and his deputy to bring out the book saying, we were set up to fail.
Right. Answer.
Well, I don't think set up to fail
that's their phrase.
Well, you know, obviously they were probably on their book marketing campaign, and you know, people will say some fairly provocative things, but I don't
maybe
think
say
well, what you won't
Nick,
find,
yeah, how would it help sell a book, Nick Pope, if you say you had no funds and you were set up to fail? I don't think I'd rush out to buy that book.
No, well, it's a provocative statement though against the administration, but what you won't hear them say is, you know, look, we have changed our mind, and by the way, we think 9/11 was an inside job. They're not saying that.
Hang on, Nick. What you will find them saying, if you read very closely, is that they came very close to prosecuting Pentagon officials for perverting the course of justice by failing to produce evidence and by erasing tapes
People were undoubtedly trying to cover their backsides and make their own contribution and their own agency come out of this on top, and certainly not here as an apologist for the US regime, and mistakes were made, but these are intelligent
animation. Is that book on Nick's desk, is that a backside covering operation?
It's an absolute load of lies, that book. They lie, they distort, they omit all sorts of key evidence and information from that day. In fact, there's been an amazing rebuttal to that book written by a professor, David Ray Griffin, called 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and I recommend anybody to go and read that. And I should point out as well that that commission was only called after 441 days due to pressure from the families and survivors. The government resisted and resisted and resisted having any sort of inquiry into the seminal terrorist attack around the planet. And it was only because of family members that they actually went ahead and did that. Now, compare and contrast how quickly the US government rushed into inquiries into the Kennedy assassination, all sorts of other major scandals,
you've been keeping your powder dry.
You are actually kind of
President Clinton.
Right.
But the thing is, you know, you had different
presidents. We'll use indoor language if we can.
And finally, my latest 9/11 update. Canadian MP ditches candidate over remarks about 9/11. This from CTV.ca. Stephane Dion, D-I-O-N, began his day defending Leslie Hughes over accusations of anti-Semitism. But by lunchtime Friday, the Liberal leader had unceremoniously dumped the Winnipeg area candidate in an abrupt move that seemed as much about removing the tarnish of intolerance from the party brand as it did with buffing his leadership image. Hughes came under fire for an old blog posting in which she suggested Israeli intelligence warned the United States in advance of the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center and that Israeli businesses vacated the premises beforehand. Hughes later described herself as a lifelong friend and supporter of the Jewish community in Winnipeg. Nonetheless, she apologized for the perception that she is anti-Semitic, but the apology wasn't enough for her party leader. The Liberal Party's commitment to tolerance and multiculturalism is paramount, Dion said in a statement. I have reviewed the past comments of Leslie Hughes, and it is clear they do not meet this standard. While I appreciate her apology, I cannot condone those sentiments in any way. I have therefore asked Ms. Hughes to step down as the Liberal Party candidate in Kildonan, St. Paul. So that's Leslie Hughes, and there are links in that article to read about Stephane Dion and Leslie Hughes. But let's address quickly these crazy conspiracy theories. First, that Israeli intelligence warned the U.S. in advance of the 9/11 attacks. So let's again go, my friends, to historycommons.org, the complete 9/11 timeline. Summer 2001, Israel warns U.S. of big attack. The Associated Press will report in May 2002, quote, Israeli intelligence services were aware several months before 9/11 that bin Laden was planning a large-scale terror attack, but did not know what his targets would be, Israeli officials have said. An Israeli official speaking on condition of anonymity tells the Associated Press shortly after the attacks that, quote, everybody knew about a heightened alert and knew that bin Laden was preparing a big attack. He said information was passed on to Washington, but denied Israel had any concrete intelligence that could have been used to prevent the September 11th attacks. Source, Associated Press. The claim that Israel lacks concrete intelligence is contradicted by other media reports, and you can hit three different links to back up that. So, that first one is debunked, so that's not a conspiracy theory, anti-Semitic rhetoric. And the other one, Israeli businesses vacated the premises beforehand. Again, historycommons.org. September 4th, 2001, Israeli company moves out of World Trade Center. The Zim American Israeli Shipping Company, ZIM, Zim American Israeli Shipping Company moves their North American headquarters from the 16th floor of the World Trade Center to Norfolk, Virginia, 1 week before the 9/11 attacks. The Israeli government owns 49% of the company. Zim announced the move and its date 6 months earlier. Source, the Virginian Pilot. And again, those are pre-9/11 sources. More than 200 workers had just been moved out. About 10 are still in the building making final moving arrangements on 9/11, but escape. Source, Jerusalem Post. The move only leaves one Israeli company, Clear Forest, with 18 employees in the World Trade Center on 9/11. The four or five employees in the building at the time escape. Source, Jerusalem Post. 1 year later, a Zim ship is impounded while attempting to ship Israeli military equipment to Iran. It is speculated that this is done with the knowledge of Israel. Source, AFP. So that's just a little addendum about the activities of Zim. So, another one, debunked. Israeli intelligence did warn the U.S. in advance of 9/11, regardless of how specific it was. And Israeli businesses vacated the premises of the World Trade Center before 9/11, breaking their lease and eating a bunch of money. So, it's not a conspiracy theory. We're going to move now to the other important news that hasn't been getting the attention that it deserves because, of course, you know, our economy's collapsing, you know. But Pakistan in the crosshairs. And I've got two long posts up. The first one, Pakistan in the crosshairs, bombs, black ops, and Bhutto. What frames a lot of this latest activity is, of course, the huge truck bomb that strikes the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad. And this is going back to Sunday, September 21st. And this from winterpatriot.blogspot.com. A huge truck bomb exploded at the entrance of the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad on Saturday evening, killing at least 40 people and wounding more than 150. This according to Carlotta Gall, who reports from Pakistan and Afghanistan for the New York Times. Quote, "The blast, one of the worst acts of terrorism in Pakistan's history, went off just a few hundred yards from the Prime Minister's house, where all the leaders of the government were dining after the President's address to the Parliament. An address which was reported as a broadside against both terrorism and U.S. intervention. In addition to the speech mentioned above, this attack comes mere days after Pakistan's announcement that its military would fight back if American troops attacked on its soil again, and a few days before a scheduled meeting between the presidents of Pakistan and the USA, at which the fight against terrorism is on the agenda, or is the agenda. Thus, the timing can hardly be coincidental. And as you can see quite clearly from all these photos posted up and links to them, this attack is on the order of magnitude beyond the suicide terrorism which occurs in Pakistan on a regular basis. In other words, it appears to be state-sponsored, and you can probably guess which state. You might think everybody would hate these terrorists, but you'd be wrong. Some people like them. For some people, terror is good for business. The presidential candidates lost no time in pointing fingers, even though they have no idea who's behind the atrocity. So there you have it. Jumping down. There you have it. The government was elected, but the threat is enduring, and that's all the pretext these guys need for another 100 years of war. But what the heck, your kids weren't planning to do anything different with their lives, were they? Let's get into the questionable timing of this Pakistan blast. This from 9/11 blogger. Let's see if we got this straight. Over the past 7 years, we've dumped billions and billions of dollars into Pakistan to help with the GWAT. Yet we know that former President Musharraf spent much of that money beefing up his military presence on the border of India, while another large part of that money just went missing. Some of that money was traced to election fraud attempts. All of this and the accepted wisdom is that the Taliban and bin Laden are in Pakistan, course, we all think he's dead, but that's beside the point. When Musharraf lost the election, he shut down democracy in Pakistan and arrested judges and opposition party leaders. Eventually, Pakistan shamed us by actually impeaching their president for corruption, while ours gets off scot-free thanks to Nancy Pelosi and a complicit Congress. Along comes a new president, President Asif Zardari, Z-A-R-D-A-R-I, Zardari, one that isn't in the pocket of Bush Co., and lo and behold, we start ramping up the rhetoric about needing to attack inside Pakistan whenever we feel like it. They even get the leading progressive man-god Obama to spin the same bullshit story. Now, after several weeks of international bad press because of drone planes being piloted by 19-year-olds with joysticks in California, blowing up families in Pakistan willy-nilly, and there's your links for you, and we'll cover some of that. After all that, the terrorists in Pakistan decide to blow up a second-rate hotel there, killing civilians and making them the bad guys once again. How's that for the worst timing ever, huh? Well, the worst timing for them, and the best possible timing for those troubled U.S. military PR guys and all the politicians who had been saying just months ago we needed to step up military action in Pakistan. Let's face it, the global war on terror is the biggest thing since sliced bread for making serious cash, removing those troubling restrictions and undermining the Constitution at every turn. Now, some of the backup to all this, things I'd bookmarked, and then this Marriott explosion happened. So, before the bombing, all of the following things were going on. A new article from former CIA man Robert Baer, who again, Syriana, and says 9/11 probably inside job. And of course, there's that shot. Oh no, I'm confusing it with traffic that has the 9/11 scorpion boxes. Anyway. Washington is risking war with Pakistan. As Wall Street collapsed with a bang, almost no one noticed that we're on the brink of war with Pakistan. And unfortunately, that's not too much of an exaggeration. The Pakistan's military ordered its forces along the Afghan border to repulse all future American military incursions into Pakistan. The story has been subsequently downplayed, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, flew to Islamabad, Pakistan's capital, to try to ease tensions. But the fact remains that American forces have and are violating Pakistani sovereignty. Now from the Associated Press, unknown powder sent to U.S. diplomats in Pakistan. Two American diplomatic outposts in Pakistan received envelopes containing an unknown white powder, sparking a security scare, a U.S. embassy spokesman said. Tests were being conducted on the substance. Spokesman Lou Fintor said he declined to comment on whether any embassy staffers had become ill or were under observation. The envelopes were sent to the U.S. consulate in Karachi and the U.S. embassy in Islamabad. Fintor said both facilities have remained open with no plans to close them, saying, quote, embassy personnel followed established response procedures. We applaud the rapid and appropriate response by our mailroom and security staff to contain any potential threats. We take threats of this type very seriously, hoax or not. He would not say where the envelopes had been mailed from, pending an investigation, or to whom they were addressed. And there's links in there to UPI to read more about that. So, mysterious powder showing up again in Islamabad, in the capital, where Mike Mullen was. Negotiations, saber-rattling, Marriott blows up. And also from the Associated Press, Benazir Bhutto's widower is the man who's been elected as Pakistan's president, who we just mentioned a few moments ago. Not in the pocket of Bush Co. Benazir Bhutto's widower swept Pakistan's presidential election, offering hope for stability to a nuclear-armed country feeling intense U.S. pressure to crack down on Islamic militants. In a grim reminder of the problems awaiting Asif Ali Zardari, rescuers in the Northwest dug with their hands for survivors after at least 30 people were killed in a massive suicide bombing. Already head of the main ruling party, Zardari becomes one of the most powerful civilian leaders in Pakistan's turbulent 61-year history. Last month, he marshaled a coalition that forced stalwart U.S. ally Pervez Musharraf to quit as head of state. So that's just part one of Pakistan and the crosshairs, and we've got a little bit of audio to listen to about the Marriott blast.
Just hours after Pakistan suffered one of its biggest terrorist attacks in memory, residents have begun to bury loved ones who died in the attack. The suicide bombing at the Marriott Hotel, a favorite of foreigners and Pakistan's elite, claimed dozens of lives and injured hundreds more. It comes at a time of growing anger in Pakistan over a wave of cross-border strikes on militant bases by U.S. forces in Afghanistan. One resident of Islamabad expressed despair at the government's ability to curb extremist attacks. It's very bad, especially for poor people, this man says. They never seem to catch these suicide bombers. Bombing came hours after Pakistan's new president, Asif Ali Zardari, made his first address to Parliament, less than a mile from the hotel. After the blast, he appeared on state television to condemn what he called, quote, a cowardly attack. According to U.S. intelligence officials, a recently released al-Qaeda video threatened attacks against Western interests in Pakistan, and a top official in Islamabad said authorities had received intelligence there might be militant activity due to the new president's address, and added that security in the capital had been tightened. A spokesman at the State Department says at least one American was killed in the blast and several others were wounded. Many other foreigners were hurt as well. Pakistan has recently faced a wave of militant attacks as it has launched offenses against insurgents near the border with Afghanistan. And this wasn't the first suicide blast at this Marriott Hotel. In January 2007, a suicide bomber triggered a blast outside the hotel that killed a security guard and wounded seven others. Sophia Manos, The Associated Press.
A U.S. missile killed five people in a Pakistani village less than a day after Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, restated American respect for Pakistan's sovereignty. According to Radio Australia, four missiles fired from a suspected U.S. drone hit a compound in South Waziristan near the Afghan border yesterday. The reported attack will likely fuel anger in Pakistan over an escalation in cross-border operations by U.S. forces, including a September 3rd ground assault that has strained the seven-year anti-terror alliance between the two allies. A week after the initial assault, Pakistani Army Chief General Ashfaq Kayani issued a strong public rebuke of the U.S., saying Pakistan's territorial integrity will be defended at all costs. He added, "Falling for short-term gains while ignoring our long-term interest is not the right way forward." Mullen was in Pakistan to meet with Prime Minister Reza Gilani and General Kayani to try to lessen military tensions with Pakistan after it was revealed in a New York Times article that President George Bush approved of U.S. attacks on militants in Pakistani tribal areas bordering Afghanistan. In an interview with the BBC, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates defended the right of American forces to strike at militants on the Pakistani side of the Afghan border.
I wouldn't go in that direction. I would just say that we will take whatever actions are necessary to protect our troops.
On Thursday, Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi told reporters that Pakistani officials were unaware of the suspected strike late Wednesday.
Whether they informed us? No, sir. We were not informed. Now, when the statement that was made by Admiral Mullen yesterday, you've seen that, I'm sure, you know, the press has read about it. It's a clear commitment to Pakistan's respect of Pakistan's sovereignty. Mullen is saying that. And when he says that, I have to respect that and I have to understand that. Now, if, having said that, there was an attack later in the night, that means there is some sort of a institutional disconnect on their side.
In a column on the website Tom Dispatch, Pakistani-born journalist and writer Tariq Ali suggests this is a carefully coordinated move to weaken the Pakistani state yet further by creating a crisis that extends way beyond the badlands on the frontier with Afghanistan. Its effects on Pakistan could be catastrophic, creating a severe crisis within the army and in the country at large. The overwhelming majority of Pakistanis are opposed to the U.S. presence in the region, viewing it as the most serious threat to peace.
And now to the second posting, Pakistan still in the crosshairs, questions, red alert, and open fire. First from Pakistan International News, U.S. jets violate Pak airspace again. Two U.S. jet fighters Saturday night again intruded into Pakistan airspace over South Waziristan, causing panic among the tribesmen. However, neither the security forces nor the tribesmen fired upon the fighter planes. Sources in the tribal agency confirmed to the news that two U.S. jet fighters for about 20 minutes hovered over Angor Adda, Baghar, and Momentanji area of the agency. The planes that came across the border from troubled Paktika province of Afghanistan after the flight over the area went back without any action. And I've started to lose track now of all the provocative moves in and across the border and suicide bombings and drone attacks and firing at planes and didn't fire at planes. But if we jump to the Daily Times, again out of Pakistan, Taseer says he will impose economic martial law if empowered. Punjab Governor Salman Taseer, T-A-S-E-E-R, says if empowered, he will impose an economic martial law and resolve the economic problems facing Pakistan. Speaking on GeoTV's Ek Din Geo Ke Saath, which means a day with Geo, Taseer said he remained in prison when Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz Chief Nawaz Sharif was Chief Minister of Punjab, adding, "But neither I begged for pardon nor did I bow before anyone." There's a link, again, to Daily News out of Pakistan. 20 questions about 9:20, which is when the Marriott blast happened. But rather than go through those 20 questions, which I implore you to do, we're going to get to some of that, and I think actually there's an article coming up that kind of succinctly goes through it. But if we jump to the CBS and Associated Press, Pakistan on red alert. Pakistan security officials put all the country's airports on red alert Thursday after intelligence warnings of a suicide attack. Quote, "We had very credible information of a suicide attempt in Islamabad, which prompted this step," end quote, a senior security official told CBS News Farhan Bukhari. The official spoke on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to address the matter. Now, if we move to Danger Room, Pakistan's soldiers fire on U.S. copters. Their president may be getting all flirty with our VP candidate. And there's a funny picture of, course, Sarah Palin and Zardari. But in the meantime, Pakistan's troops and American forces are getting into firefights with increasing regularity. The latest incident, of course, as of this writing, Pakistani soldiers fired on U.S. helicopters while those choppers were still in Afghan airspace. The shooting comes just a day after an American Predator spy drone mysteriously went down in Pakistan, and a week after Pakistani generals ordered their soldiers to, quote, open fire if U.S. troops cross the border. Reports of skirmishes between American and Pakistani forces have become more and more common, but mostly they've been based on semi-reliable Pakistani accounts or on secondhand information. American officials have been reluctant to confirm anything on the record, but this latest incident was reported by the Pentagon's own Armed Forces Press Service. Now, an update to this posted on Danger Room. As soon as this post was published yesterday, commentator Jim smelled something fishy with the Pentagon's version of what went down. He wrote, quote, "Pakistan troops on the Pakistani side of the border initiated small arms fire against the helicopters while they were still a mile inside Afghan airspace. Now the range of most small arms is at best 1,000 yards. A helicopter pilot would be lucky to even see an AK muzzle flash from a mile away, slightly more if it's a heavier machine gun. Methinks someone is lying and it isn't the Pakistanis." Turns out, commentator Jim was dead on. This was a firefight between Pakistani and U.S. Afghan ground patrols, American officials tells the Washington Post. So, I think the thing that sums it up, and there are more, and there's even more updates as of today, but I think Lee Rogers at RogueGovernment.com sums up the Marriott blast 9:20 quite well with the article, "Official Story of Pakistan Truck Bombing is a Lie." The recent truck bombing at the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad, Pakistan, has been sold to the people of the world as an operation conducted by a bloodthirsty Al-Qaeda suicide bomber. The official story states that an Al-Qaeda suicide bomber blew up the Marriott Hotel with a truck bomb, killing 53 people and injuring hundreds. And you can link and read about the official story over on The Scotsman. Surveillance video, which we do have, and you can check that out, it's posted up. Surveillance video of the so-called truck bomb that they claim caused all this death and destruction shows an explosion so weak that it was incapable of doing any real damage to a security shack that was located just a few feet away from it from where the truck was parked, and you can see guys run away. People who were roughly 15 to 20 feet from the blast were even able to run away from the explosion. I just said that. It's laughable to think that this truck bomb was responsible for causing massive damage to the Marriott Hotel, killing and injuring all those people. Watching the video is proof that it was just a cover story for the real operation. Foreign news outlets, including the Daily Pakistan, reported that there was a contingent of U.S. Marines who were in the hotel guarding boxes with unknown contents at the same time that this truck bombing occurred. With all this in mind, it's obvious that we're not getting the full story. What's even more ridiculous about the official story is the fact that they want us to believe that an Al-Qaeda suicide bomber would attack a hotel in a country that's on uncertain terms with the U.S. In fact, the Pakistan military has recently been in combat with U.S. military units that have violated their national border. The official story simply doesn't make any sense and can easily be written off as a lie. Again, why would that benefit them in any way? So, a few things as well. Again, out of Pakistan, Marriott attack, 9/11 executed by U.S. From Wikinews, CCTV footage shows bombing of Islamabad Marriott. If we jump to the BBC, militants claim Marriott attack, but if we jump to Winter Patriot, because you'll believe anything, unknown terrorist group claims responsibility for Marriott bombing. McClatchy has a stopped truck, 3 confused minutes, and a horrible blast. And that's basically what the video shows. Warning on terrorist attack in Islamabad received 3 days before the attack. That comes from Xinhua Net out of China. Foreign press reports Marriott Marines mystery. That's from InfoWars. Why would terrorists want to decapitate anti-U.S. leadership in Pakistan? And finally, what was that mysterious activity in the Marriott by U.S. Marines? And again, that's out of Pakistan. Updates to all of this. Pakistan replaces chief of powerful spy agency. This from the AFP. Pakistan has appointed a new head of its powerful inter-services intelligence agency, the ISI, amid U.S. accusations that the military spy organization secretly backs Taliban rebels on the Afghan border. Lieutenant General Ahmed Shuja Pasha, P-A-S-H-A, formerly head of military operations, was named director of the ISI late Monday, a terse military statement announced. He replaces Lieutenant General Nadim Taj, T-A-J. The move is a part of a major shakeup in the Army's top brass after U.S., Afghan, and Indian officials alleged in recent months that the shadowy organization was complicit in the Taliban insurgency racking the region. Now, of course, we have to mention the ISI, former head of the ISI, Mahmoud Ahmed, of course, connected to the wiring of $100,000 to Mohammed Atta, and also meeting around 9/11 with Porter Goss and others. Next from the BBC, several killed in U.S. drone attack. A pilotless American drone has fired missiles into a border area of Pakistan, killing at least 4 people, Pakistani security officials say. Officials said a house was hit near the town of Mir Ari in North Waziristan and 9 people were injured. Reports say the missiles were fired after the drone was shot at. Tension between the U.S. and Pakistan has increased over cross-border incursions against militants by American military based in Afghanistan. And final update, returning to dailytimes.com.pk out of Pakistan. Continuing U.S. losses will lead to military strikes on Pakistan. If the United States forces in Afghanistan continue to suffer casualties inflicted by insurgents crossing over from Pakistan, the next administration, whether Republican or Democrat, will come under tremendous public pressure to make direct strikes on Pakistani targets, according to three South Asia experts. The observations came in a meeting organized by Khawaja M. Ashraf, president of the Pakistani American Congress, in Pakistan on Sunday. And the three experts who spoke on the prevailing situation in the region were Walter Anderson of Johns Hopkins University, Rodney Jones, who runs a local Pakistani consultancy, and Jonathan Landy of McClatchy Newspapers, who has extensive experience in traveling in and writing about the region. So there you have it, my friends, the latest on Pakistan and the crosshairs. So we've got Bhutto, black ops and bombings and questions and red alerts and open fire. And so we can only hold our breath. And that's, I believe, going to do it, my friends, for this B-side of episode 93 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. And I thank you for listening and sharing the show and giving me your feedback. I appreciate it. MediaMonarchy@yahoo.com or MediaMonarchy. You can IM me just about any time. And yes, so as we head into these last few hours of September and these mythical talks of economy collapse and martial law and canceled elections and greater depression and God knows what else. Again, a lot of fear, a lot of paranoia, but the one thing we do know is, yes, we're in some serious shit and things don't look very good. And we know that combat brigades are beginning to patrol here in America in just a few short hours on October 1st, 2008. So again, my friends, let's not lose our heads. Let's not get crazy with speculation, but let's stay active and aware and stay close to one another. And again, let's not be divided, for we will be conquered, most certainly. And we'll get through this together, my friends and brothers and sisters. So thank you for listening. I appreciate it. My name's James. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
I mean, so it's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.